You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Katie Didden. Katie, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Katie, I know we're going to talk about your books and work. I'm also curious just about where you are. You're in Muncie, Indiana, and you're a professor there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I teach creative writing at Ball State. And yeah, I live in Muncie, which people refer to it as Middletown because of the famous documentary series that happened here. But it also really is about 2 hours from all sorts of cities. 1 hour from Indianapolis, 2 hours from Dayton, 2 hours from Cincinnati, 3 hours from Chicago. It's really in the middle. So.
And so how does that feel just geographically? You're in the middle as a writer, an artist, a poet. What does that feel like? Does that feel nourishing and good? I'm just always curious about people who live in places that are outside major city centers or wherever they are. How is it there?
Right. Well, I've lived all over the country. I think when you ask any academic lately for their map, most people I know have lived in many different places, many different cities. And so in that sense, I've come to figure out that there are just a few things that I really value. And one is having some body of water. And so here in Muncie, we have the White River. And I spend a lot of time there walking or running by the river, and a good library and a good group of artsy people. So that's definitely here in Muncie.
Well, that's what I'm curious about, the good group of artsy people. That's what I'm always looking for everywhere. I'm curious how they form. So the good group of artsy people, is that from, you know, your school, or is there like a nonprofit that helps to facilitate that?
That's a good question. I mostly know that group from my colleagues at school, and so I've become friends with people in the art department here, people in the dance department, and my colleagues in creative writing. I have an exceptional group of colleagues who are really committed to writing and thinking and doing great work. So, but there are a lot of artistic projects happening in Muncie. In fact, there's a new art residency that has just started. I think it's called Ply Space. And some of the artists who run that we're having our first film festival. So that's actually more related to the community. And there is actually a really interesting art space, another art space called Minatrista here. So yeah, there's interesting things happening. I think people are attracted to being here because there's a low cost of living, and that creates tons of possibilities. So
thanks. That always fascinates me, just how, you know, artists manage, survive, and express themselves and show work in different areas. So thanks for that. Let's talk about your work now. I know you're also going to be reading a little bit. I know we talked a little bit about the lava on Iceland, which is your current work. And I know your first book, The Glacier's Wake, which relates to this one somehow, right? Is that what you were saying? Could you tell me a little bit about how your first book, The Glacier's Wake, relates to the lava on Iceland, which is, I believe, the manuscript or series you're working on now?
Yeah, I'd be glad to talk about that. I have always been fascinated with geology ever since I took this terrific geology class in college called Ring of Fire. And I was studying geology at the same time I was taking my first poetry workshop. So those two subjects kind of fused in my mind. So when I often find that I'm inspired in poems by thinking about the earth and its, tectonic shiftings and all the, dramatic landscapes. And so in The Glacier's Wake, I have a lot of poems that feature not only glaciers, but craters and deserts and waterfalls, and that's always been my kind of go-to image realm. I just wrote an essay. Twyla Tharp, in her book The Creative Habit, writes about how all artists have a DNA for a distance, and that some are close up, some are middle distance, some are great distance, And I am definitely the great distance variety of artist. For some reason, that's what activates my imagination. And so in the first book, I have three different threads in the book of persona poems, where I take on the voice of a glacier and a sycamore and a wasp. And for each of those voices, in order to achieve a distinct voice, I use different poetic forms. And so the glacier is a jagged free verse form. The wasp form are these really tiny cinched tercets. And for the sycamore, I use these Welsh syllabic rhyming forms. They're very intricate. And I also assigned each of those personae a secret secondary persona, because I found that this was a good way to cut against the sentimentality of anthropomorphizing natural creatures and features. And just to make it a little weirder and a little more unexpected. So the glacier is also a former Hollywood starlet in my mind. And the sycamore is also a minister. And the wasp is kind of an academic generalist. And so each of those characters will then kind of speak about different subjects. And that double lens will create an interesting take on whatever subject it is. Like the sycamore talks about praise, or the sycamore talks about forgiveness, and the glacier talks about middle age and things, you know, just concepts. And so I really loved working in that style, because normally with poetry, each poem is self-contained. So when you come to write your next poem, you're starting with a blank page. And I loved working with a series, because I always had a starting place. It was almost kind of like having company. So when I would come to the page, I had a sense of where to begin. And it was in conversation with other poems. And I loved that process. I really found that to be incredibly generative. And so even though the book was published, I wanted to write poems in the voice of lava. And when I was thinking about what form would actually help me to achieve that voice, the poetic form of erasure came to mind, which is when you take a block of prose, and a lot of people use ink, and they ink out words of the text and leave the poem behind, like a lyric poem inside the paragraph. And I thought that the ink moving over the page was really... it had a kind of resonance with lava spilling over landscape. And the more I've worked with, the more I've found that the other thing that's been kind of amazing about it is that it ends up being a composite form, because I'm using different source texts about Iceland. And then I also collaborate with a graphic designer who layers the text in grayscale over photographs that we solicit from friends of ours. So it's a really composite form. And once again, I find it really generative.
I like that. You mentioned that form of erasure. I've never heard of that as a form before. I know of artists that have used that as kind of their art form, you know, or they've made...
Right.
I've seen artists make books about that where... there's all this text and it looks like it's, you know, blacked out, like the FBI went through it or something. But what you're left with is a kind of, I guess it's not a concrete poem, but some kind of remaining text that has a new meaning. Is that an exercise or a form in itself? Because you refer to it as erasure, and I never heard of that before.
Yeah, I would call it a form. And I think it's actually, there's kind of a... there's kind of a trend for creating erasure poems. If you were to Google it, you would just see hundreds and hundreds of examples of people who are using this as a form. And it's a controversial form, and I've written a lot about this, but because you start with a source text, and there's a poet, Solma Sharif, who has this essay where she really asks the question, can anybody participate in a forum like this without echoing state tactics of disappearance or redaction? And some people mark the trend, the fact that we have so many poets using this forum as a response to 9/11, and other people see it as a response to government censorship. And Solma Sharif's article really asks you to think about how it draws attention to the fact of obliteration. And so it's controversial because some people would say, who are you to erase the source text, that that's actually somebody else's words? So that's something I wrestle with a lot in the forum. And so when I publish these, I don't erase the source text. I preserve it so that you can see it, and then it becomes more like a palimpsest where the poem is indexical and it's pointing you back to the original. But it's a very popular form. A lot of people, for example, did erasures of Trump's inauguration speech. And so oftentimes it can be a political act where people are speaking back to the primary text. And in my case, it responds to the primary text in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it responds to it in kind of a sonic way, where if there's a patterning in the first text, I'll pick up on some of the sound patterns. Sometimes it responds in a contrary way. Sometimes it responds in a conversation or more like a harmonizing. And sometimes there's not an obvious relationship between the final poem and the original, but I erase them to the voice of lava. So it's as if the lava is speaking.
I like that. So let's begin with that. The lava on Iceland, you know, of course, just that title, just those words I love, because it sounds like an impossibility. And we know that there are volcanoes on Iceland, and very well-known ones, but it sounds like an impossibility. How could there be lava on ice?
Right. Right. That's interesting.
I'd love you to read something. Tell me what you'd like to read.
Well, usually when I read these poems, I will start with the first line of the source text, and then I'll read the erasure. So I'll start with this one, which is, so the artist William Morris spent a lot of time in Iceland, and he kept these beautiful journals about his time there, and he was just an incredible writer. And so this comes from one of his journals. I'll read the first sentence from his journal, and then I'll read the erasure. Meantime, we got off our horses and sat down in a pretty grassy hollow, and the Icelanders brought out champagne and glasses to drink the stirrup cup, for they were going back here. So in half an hour's time, we said goodbye for 6 weeks, and they mounted and turned back west. Okay, so here's the erasure. And this is the voice of lava. Meteors petrify me. Dead matter vanished into the scantiest of tracks. A white flare, eerily anonymous. I am the Earth's aorta. I drum against erosion. O spur of the alien cosmos, slinging nerves with feral nickels, fall back into a flat curve just above our resting place. Be no harbinger. Usher us Godwards, unthreatened, on the pulse of our surprise.
Thank you, Katie. So before you read the next one, I want to ask you some questions about the relationship of the first text you wrote to that, because perhaps in this interview there'll be images of this, but I don't have one exactly now. So when you read a line from that text, the first line, obviously that wasn't the line you were drawing from. He wrote a much longer text, is what
right.
I'm understanding, and the words that you just read are parts of that much longer text that started with the line that you first read from William Morris?
Right, and so one thing that I do that other people who do erasure don't always do is that I go down to the letters of words. And so in order to get the word meteor, I found that in the first part of the sentence, meantime we got off our horses. So inside, meantime we got off our horses, is the word meteors.
Right. That's what I couldn't understand. Like, where did that word come from? So that's fascinating, which makes it quite different than other aspects of erasure, where, because typically what I see of erasure, and I haven't looked a lot into erasure poems, and I will look into it more after this, it's usually people leave the entire words, right? Or maybe break
right.
up one, but very, like, as you're saying, very rarely do you just see, if at all, just the letters to make your own word.
Right, and I do that because I really like sound in poetry, and I want a little more control with rhythm and rhyme. And I find that when I'm writing these, for some reason, the voice of lava rhymes. The lava, in my perception, is a rhymer, and so using the individual letters lets me do that.
Well, I love that, and I'd like you to read another one from The Lava on Iceland, which is a series that you're working on, and it's not completed. When will it be complete? How will you know that this series or this book is done?
I'm hoping to finish it this summer, and I just had a vision for the final subsection of the book. I traveled to Iceland in 2016, and I did research on the 1783 eruption of the Lakagígar volcano system, which had a devastating effect worldwide. It lowered global temperatures, and it caused worldwide drought, and it was really devastating for Iceland. And in fact, they think of it as it might have been the originary cause of the French Revolution, because it caused crop failures in Europe. So anyway, I am approaching that subject. I'm doing a new method, which I call a double erasure, which is an interview. So I erase the text to find a question, and then however far I get in the prose, that's the amount of territory I have to find the answer. And I'm going to be interviewing the lava from three different perspectives, a scientist, a priest, and the Völuspá of Norse mythology. And I want those three different angles to invite all kinds of questions about what does it mean for people to endure that kind of climate change. And so I
Okay, so that's really interesting. Before you read that, so to be clear about that, you're still pulling from the William Morris text in writing the voices that you just spoke of?
No, actually, I use all different source texts, so that's also something that's slightly different from other people. So I have, you know, everything from a Siggy's yogurt label to, you know, Haldor Laxness, passages from his novel Independent People. I have interviews with Bjork. I have a lot of different interviews with politicians in Iceland. So it's kind of an archive of my idiosyncratic research, really, of how does one get to know this culture and try to understand the history and how that history has affected the world, really. And, you know, I have one that I just completed of an article about Reagan and Gorbachev's summit in Reykjavik trying to work towards nuclear disarmament. And so it's kind of... So even the source texts are composite. It's like a mixture. So when I do the work on 1783, there are some first-hand accounts of people who survived it, but I'm looking at more secondary sources of scientists who've analyzed it or geologists who've tracked the effects of that eruption. And I have found source texts that I'll be using, but I haven't completed the process yet for those.
Okay, so now you're going to read to us from this interview, and you're going to read will you read it the way you did the other one, a portion of the source text, and then the poem?
I'm happy to. I actually don't have the erasure interviews done yet. That's how I'm going to finish the book. I haven't finished those.
Oh,
so
right.
I can read you some. I'll read you some other.
Okay.
Okay. So this is from an article on the Icelandic women's strike, and it is written by Anadis Rudolfsdóttir, and it's the article is called The Day the Women Went on Strike. The atmosphere at the rally was incredible. Sigrun Bjornsdóttir was a student of 19 and had just found out she was pregnant. So that's the first line of that article. And here's the lava. The sphere's credo, sudden metamorphosis. O crowd, even iron's mutable. Eden, overlaid in gravel, yowls. Scribes annotate the ruin. Stars, marled with clay, buttress the margins. So the city grid looks helpless, a fly in a galactic web. Drenched in silver, women on Earth, a trail of battered shields, a scorched field.
Thank you. And let's hear one more. You have one more ready for us from this series?
Yeah, I'd be happy to read that. So the lava's secret secondary persona is an artist, someone concerned with the line, the blurring line between creation and destruction. So this is from Guðmundur Hafdanarson's Historical Dictionary of Iceland, and he's defining the Alþingi, which was the Parliament of Iceland. Alþingi is a central institution in Icelandic history and public life. It traces its history back to the beginning of the Commonwealth period, although the modern, democratically elected Alþingi has little in common with its medieval namesake. And here's the erasure. Art is central, sun and stone. I trace the beginning of the modern. I paint veils. The old fear arises that the public won't care, that the sea is the true genius. I change when I meet air, sending embers arcing in syncopating showers. I still blanch at the void. The answer is, again and again, to erase the ground. My dearest friends are drawn to the same fire.
I love that. Thank you so much, Katie.
Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, lava is so exciting to hear it speak, you know, as a character, as a voice that I imagine you must be excited about, and you get more and more involved with it. It's a tremendous force, right? A geological force, but also so much more. It's the, you know, like the core of the earth, and I don't know, all of these things that we have associations with Pompeii and everything. As you keep writing these, you must be getting more and more involved in the voice of lava, right? And what that actually is. Is that something that's kind of cumulative and growing as you continue to do this ability to kind of know lava more?
Definitely. I think that I have, I guess it's sharpened my antenna for all things lava. And I remember that when I started this book, I was in a PhD program, and my colleagues who were doing dissertations, I remember admiring that when they committed to a subject, everybody knew that that was the subject that they were studying, and so whenever anyone came across anything related to that, they would send it to them. And I thought, you know, as a poet, where normally my interests are poem to poem, you don't always have that kind of commitment or even a sense of that deep study. And so it really has been tremendous. It's, you know, I've been working on this for about 8 years, and just, yeah, discovering more and more, and it alters the way that I observe things, and it alters sort of my desire for travel, things I want to see or notice. So, but it's also interesting because there's so many constraints on the voice that I really don't feel like I have a lot of control. It feels more or like an oracle or like a Ouija board kind of thing. And what has really astonished me is the fact that the voice is so consistent, even though I'm using all of these different source texts. So there's something at work there that feels both consistent but also beyond my control. And it does have a kind of, however it's coming about in these poems is revealing to me how I think of it as kind of a dragon-esque voice or a godlike voice. And so it's definitely fictionalized in terms of how I am representing it. So
I can see that. That's so fascinating. So let me ask you what you're reading at the moment, the question I ask everybody at the end.
I have a huge stack of books on my nightstand, and one of them that I'm loving every night I'm reading from is Carl Phillips' new book of poems called Wild as the Wind. And I just think he's an incredible poet, and I find that I really savor his lines. At the same time, I'm reading Tommy Pico's Nature poem, which is a totally different idiom, but I also love it, and I'm really admiring how he is, I don't know, not shying away from social media and our day-to-day activities with Twitter and how that has become part of the lyric poem. He writes this really long poem, and it just sort of, I'm getting swept up in the rush of it. I really dig it. And then I'm also reading a book of essays called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And I'm teaching a class on creative writing in the environment, and that has been sort of a central text to that class. So I kind of go back and forth between them.
Katie, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work and hearing you read as well.
Thank you so much. This has been great. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.